protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kyiv is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kyiv with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kyiv is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civili, Rome.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital, Beirut, to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians and representatives of the Resistance Front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turning around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least five rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Once again, the International Fajr Film Festival brought together filmmakers and movie critics from across the world, as well as movie lovers, this time for its 41st edition. A festival made even more special considering that the international section was reintegrated into the national festival after 6 years of holding separate events.
This year, 26 feature-length movies from 25 countries were competing in the international section. For many of them, this is their regional premiere. The movie market also allows producers and filmmakers to get to know each other and negotiate further cooperation.
I've attended the festival on behalf of the Ministry of Culture of Russia, and based on what I've seen in the past 10 days, I believe that there is a great potential for joint production.
And for those keeping an eye on the festival, the award ceremony was what they'd been waiting for.
Jaishan Kalaryar, the director of this movie.
Our jury made a slight change to the order. You'll know that it's initially for best director, but we decided that instead we would like very much to give it to a new and promising filmmaker who's both written and directed his film, so congratulations to him.
I would like to dedicate this award for the three filmmakers whom I admire, Mr. Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi.
I'm an engineer by profession, but when I got a lot of free time, I used to watch a lot of cinema. When I watched Iranian films, they had a great influence in my style. And three filmmakers, specific, Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi, and Majid Majidi, have influenced my filmmaking style a lot. And my film is a byproduct of their films.
In the national section, 24 movies were picked out of 87 entries to compete for the top award. What made the national section stand out this year was a whole new generation of first-time directors from different provinces across the country.
Taking part in a festival is what motivates most of us working in the business, and I can tell you for sure that the competition was really tough this year with young up-and-coming directors who participated.
As far as I know, there were lots of young directors taking part this year, so I can tell you for sure that this wasn't an easy competition.
With all of its glitz and glamour and prestige, the 41st Fajr International Film Festival has come to an end, but this time promising new horizons for first-time directors. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Perhaps anticipating a hero's welcome, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky traveled to the Belgian capital on Thursday with a list of demands. He has asked for long-range missiles and warplanes to use against Russian forces. He also wants Kiev to be granted EU membership without delay.
Of course, membership, and that's why, of course, we need it this year. And this year, Charles, when I say this year, I mean this year.
Those with intimate knowledge of how the EU works believe it is a pipe dream.
Turkey will not be pleased because they are already waiting since 2005 in formal discussions. Then we have the Western Balkans. Also there, something is boiling in Bosnia and Serbia. So these countries, they will say, wait a minute, what about us? And for sure, there are definitely member states who will block this.
EU leaders concluded their latest summit on Friday. The most up-to-date cost of supporting Ukraine was revealed.
And it's eye-watering.
67 billion of support we have mobilized in the last 12 months, from budget support to fast recovery, from energy supply to military capabilities, from humanitarian aid to refugee support, and we must do more.
A number of EU lawmakers encourage solidarity with Ukraine, but also want support for the bloc's own hard-pressed citizens.
Solidarity with our most vulnerable, who struggle to put food on the table or heat the home, or those in difficulty maintaining a roof over their heads.
While Zelensky was touring Europe, who was running the show back in Kiev? US and NATO commanders? The Kremlin has warned Western powers not to become too involved in the conflict. There's no doubt EU citizens have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for the people of Ukraine, but there's growing concern about the level of pressure, some might call it provocation, being exerted on Russia by Western leaders. Many are nervously asking, when might Putin say, enough is enough? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In February 1951, with the Korean War raging, the South Korean army killed more than 700 fellow South Koreans, suspected communist sympathizers. The victims of the Gochang massacre were found to be innocent civilians. Most of them were women and children. Jung Young-ju was 4 years old when much of his family was killed.
The only people around here then were very young and very old, living simple lives with no role in politics. But the soldiers rounded them up and killed them. Those young children, the elderly South Korean women, what's wrong with them? When I think about it now, I cry and can't sleep.
Since the 1990s, memorials and a museum have been established. But for decades, the massacre was suppressed by South Korea's military dictatorships and previous monuments destroyed. Early local investigators faced state-sponsored violence in prison. Survivors now seek compensation.
If the restoration of honor is to be real, I think compensation for our bereaved family must be completed.
South Korea's Supreme Court last December ruled in favor of the victims of the Gochang massacre, suggesting the state may be responsible for the killings. Lee Sung-yul is lobbying the National Assembly to pass a law outlining redress.
The court found that the victims were killed by the armed forces, so the Gochang massacre should be compensated even more than other similar incidents in South Korea. That was the ruling of the Supreme Court at the end of last year. The Gochang massacre must be compensated by the state.
The Gochang massacre represents just one episode of South Korea's often painful and forgotten past. But the divisions laid bare here remain, as survivors seek compensation and understanding from their nation. Frank Smith, Gochang, South Korea.
A ceremony in the Afghan capital Kabul has marked the 44th anniversary of Iran's Islamic Revolution, bringing together officials from Afghanistan's Taliban ruling system as well as foreign diplomats representing various countries. In the event, Shir Mohammad Abbasistanekzai, the deputy foreign minister of Afghanistan, stressed that Iran's 1979 revolution was an Islamic and popular movement.
Our neighbor and friend Iran today celebrates a movement that 44 years ago led to the foundation of an Islamic government in Iran under the leadership of late Imam Khomeini. A positive point of this revolution is that it achieved victory in a short period.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran also had an impact on other nations, especially those that had been oppressed, and inspired them to stand against tyranny.
Following the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the issue of imperialism turned into world arrogance, oppression, and justice. This Islamic viewpoint didn't remain limited to Islamic countries. Even today, you see movements against world arrogance in Latin America. It was right after the Islamic Revolution that plots of the adversaries started to fail. I can refer to the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and Iraq that happened to be big failures for the U.S.
ما پیروزیمون وقتی است که دست این اجانب
Shortly after Iran's Islamic Revolution, Afghanistan was also invaded by the Soviet Union. In those years, the Iranian Revolution inspired people here to stand against the invaders.
Afghanistan might be the country that was inspired the most by the revolution, especially in the early years following its victory. The fight against the Soviet forces in Afghanistan became more serious at that time, and it eventually led to the eviction of the Soviet Union from Afghanistan.
44 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, more and more countries commemorate their revolution and this spirit of standing against tyranny.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran 44 years ago was the beginning of a trend that in Afghanistan inspired people to expel then Soviet Union. Dullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
February 14 marks the anniversary of the Bahraini Revolution. This was one of the first revolutions of the Persian Gulf Arab countries, which is still evolving until today. From the harsh crackdowns to kangaroo courts to torture and mass arrest, the regime has crushed any form of opposition. So why does the revolution continue? Why doesn't it lead to the removal of the ruling Al-Khalifa regime? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Bahraini Revolution and see whether the opposition has any chance of taking this revolution to the next level. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Gina Ribai joins us. She's a researcher from the Bahrain Forum for Human Rights, who joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol. Welcome to you both. Gina Ribai, let me first start with you and ask you if you recall the day, February 14th, we saw protests who have erupted in Bahrain, which had erupted before, but not in the scale that it did back then. Of course, this is going back a number of years now, 2011. And it was one of the first to actually break out in the Arab world at that point. Why do you think it came about in the way that they did, in the numbers that they did back then? And of course, you know, they obviously felt not only were they marginalized, but they weren't part of the political system.
The beginning of the Bahrain revolution was part of what was called then the Arab Spring. But the people of Bahrain distinguished themselves from other peoples of the Arab Spring in that they did not demand the overthrow of the regime, but rather demanded reforms and demanded civil, political, and welfare rights, because that is what they lacked. The opposition leadership called for dialogue with the authority in order to reach a consensus that satisfies all. So the presence of the Al-Khalifa dynasty in power was not under threat, but rather it was actually a golden opportunity for the Al-Khalifa dynasty to gain popular legitimacy, even though they are an unelected dictatorial authority. However, they faced the demands with peaceful, they faced the peaceful demands and demonstrations with repression and killing, and by summoning the Peninsula Shield forces from Saudi Arabia to support the Bahraini authorities by committing massacres against the peaceful protesters. Today, the revolution continues. The people still lack what they didn't get, and actually their demands are even more. They're now demanding the unconditional and immediate release of prisoners of conscience. Mm-hmm. The people insist on their demands because they realize that by retreating or submitting, the situation will not return to the way it was before the start of the revolution on February 14, 2011, but it will become worse, and the Al-Khalifa behavior will become more vengeful and vengeful and brutal, because they clearly express grudges towards everyone who objects to their policies.
Right.
The people of Bahrain expressed their will to continue through their protests, and that they are ready to make more sacrifices until their goals are achieved. Okay. Some of these protests are held on a daily basis. We, as human rights organizations, we monitor them daily, and they're still going on.
Okay. Well, that's what we're trying to figure out here, Tony Gosling, in terms of the way that the Al-Khalifa regime has dealt with not just the protests, but the Bahrainis from that point until now. Because We're looking at, for example, how they still banned the media, doesn't operate there since 2017, unless it's in one form or another that's for any particular, for example, event, like the, I guess, the racing events, the F-15, I forget what it's called. Or if you have, for example, opposition that have been dissolved, I mean, it just makes it look like they have something to hide. They don't want any of this opposition to leak out. They've arrested, prosecuted, they've harassed, obviously, the human rights defenders, journalists, etc. What is the deal with them? Why are they trying so hard? It's been so long. If they put all that time into doing something about it, perhaps at this point something might have come out of it.
Well, look, you're quite right. Say they've got something to hide. But they're not the only Gulf state with something to hide. A lot of these countries are now normalizing relationships with Israel, if you can believe that, even though they're majority Arab countries. You know, what is going on? Something completely surreal, almost absurd. Obviously, it's not absurd for those. And I'm sorry to disappoint you, but there was no revolution. Obviously, there is a movement against the government for the repressive authoritarian regime. Human Rights Watch is talking about their human rights record as dismal. Torture is normal. Demonstrators, human rights demonstrators, are executed in Bahrain. And, of course, it was part of the 2011 Arab Spring. This is the same in many, many countries where this Arab Spring took place. In fact, in Egypt, probably one of the worst, was where the Muslim Brotherhood came to power. And what happened? The Americans intervened with the U.S., basically the Pentagon and the U.S. deep state intervened there. And then just toppled the government. And most of the people who'd been involved in the revolution, in it, as many saw it at the time in Egypt, were jailed and executed. So these were, in a way, a kind of trick by the United States in order to spark a revolution and then to identify the competition with the established order.
What do you mean tricked by the U.S. to start or spark a revolution? I'm not too sure I follow that. Can you explain that a little further?
What I'm saying is, I think the Arab Springs were, and there is evidence that there was, although of course there's a genuine movement out there, that some of that was triggered deliberately by elements in the West who wanted to flush out the opposition in these countries. Look, Bahrain is a tiny place. It's basically was used for pearl diving, and it was the British Empire that created this nightmare we have now by creating what they wanted was an independent state, a port. In the 1970s, as the British Empire was collapsing, in 1971, you got around about 1.5 million population, half of which are migrant workers there. And in 1973, in 2 years, they had to suspend the constitution. This has been basically a set up by the British, an authoritarian puppet state, which is now doing pretty much exactly what the Western world wants. And that is proved with this normalization with Israel, which is an apartheid state. As Desmond Tutu in South Africa said before he died, bless him, he's pointed out that this Israeli state is more apartheid even than South Africa was, more racist against the Palestinians because it wants to wipe the Palestinians out. Now, how can any Arab country in its normal mind be normalized relations with Israel? It's impossible.
Well, you talked about a few different issues or topics there. Let me ask you about first the so-called normalization that Bahrain was so keen to do after the UAE. I mean, pretty much within a month, established ties. Well, I said reestablished, it's a slip of the tongue, because we know behind the scenes Israel does have a relationship with these Persian Gulf Arab countries and their monarchies. One of the angles behind this normalization is said that Bahrain wanted to make sure that it's in U.S.'s, so to speak, good hands or a positive outlook from the White House on Bahrain in order to make sure that the U.S. somewhat overlooks the human rights violations that are taking place on the island. But here we are 2 years later. What did the Bahrain gain from this so-called normalization? What did it do for it?
So to speak about the base of the problem, in Bahrain there is a minority that rules the majority. What does this minority base on in order to be able to impose itself on the majority of the people? It is based solely on its alliances with strong countries, specifically USA and Britain, and now Israel. Israel is not as strong as before, but Bahrain would do anything for the USA just to stay. Al-Khalifa would do anything just to stay in power. They receive support from them, and not only their the silence on their crimes. Here I want to point out something that Sheikh Isa Qasim said today, the leader of the Bahraini opposition. He spoke about the Bahrainese authorities fight against religion. We as human rights organization, we do monitor that. But he said their fight against religion is unjustified because the authorities does not need it to maintain their rule. He said that this fight against religion is an external condition for their staying in power. Yes, to this extent, the Bahraini authorities would obey the dictates of external allies, because the basis of its very presence in power is based on its alliances with these countries. So yes, it would normalize, it would do anything
when
just
you,
so
when
that...
When you talk about religion from Sheikh Isa Qasim, are you talking about how he is saying that they are somewhat differentiating then between the Shias and the Sunnis? Because that's not that's not what really... For example, Iran doesn't look at it that way. Iran has a third party on looking this whole situation. I'm just wondering what you mean by the religion aspect there.
No, he clearly said today that there is a fight against religion. It's not a fight against a sect or just slander, creating slander between sects in Bahrain. There is a fight against Islam, as he said. Uh-huh. And he said they don't need it. Actually, we do monitor that. They do. They broke mosques, and they daily in prisons, they deprived Muslim prisoners sometimes from praying. It happens a lot. Yes, so he said they don't need it. Why do they do it? And he says it is an external dictation just for as a condition to stay in power. Yes, and we do see that clear because we do monitor it.
What are they so afraid of by doing that, though? When you say that, obviously they feel like they can relinquish the importance that the majority have in terms of, for example, the Shias. And I'm not trying to turn this into a Shia or a Sunni thing. I'm just curious about that, because they are obviously afraid by making that type of having that type of approach towards the rest of the Bahraini population, right?
Well, it happens that the majority are Shia, so they are afraid that the Shia would take over the rule. But you know what? From the beginning, the opposition, in all its sects and all its ideologies, political ideologies, some of them are not religious-based, they're only asking for, demanding for... I forgot the term in English. Reforms and civil rights and welfare rights.
Right.
Today, despite all the crimes committed by the Bahraini authorities, and despite the presence of the political opposition leaders in prisons and abroad, and despite the presence of more than 2,000 prisoners of conscience in prisons, the popular opposition forces are still calling on the authority to dialogue. The Deputy Secretary General of the Al-Wifaq National Islamic Society called on dialogue just today. They still called for dialogue because they reflect their seriousness in the demands that they always called on.
Okay.
Let me direct
that angle of what you said to our guest Tony Gosling. A call for dialogue sounds simple enough. Why doesn't the U.S. make that call? Why doesn't the U.K. make a call for the ruling family to have dialogue with the opposition, which, well, they have disbanded, but, I mean, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
Well, of course it does, but the godless West, although it sometimes talks about Christianity, of course it's just like the Knights Templar and the Crusades, it's got nothing to do with real Christianity. They look at what's been going on in Ukraine, too. There is no wish to dialogue. The idea is war, I'm afraid, because war makes a lot of money and war can grab resources. By the way, really important to stress when you're talking about Bahrain, any of your viewers that want to look into what happened there, and I mean, it's a horrific story what the regime did in the Arab Spring. Your competition, Al Jazeera, did a documentary, Shouting in the Dark, I remember watching, which is absolutely shocking to see how a government can treat its people. A government is supposed to really be a servant of its people. This government is not. It is afraid of its people. And actually, it's when I talk about the godless West, this is just another puppet regime of the West, just like Zelensky in Ukraine. Puppets, these people, are not sovereign countries whatsoever. And actually, they're puppets of an organization called CENTCOM. CENTCOM is dominates the Middle East, and it is a U.S. military office, part of the American military plans to dominate the world. They have these offices for all parts of the world. They're that arrogant. And actually, of course, the EU and the UK are also part of this, you know, this coalition, which is attempting war. Now, the reason why is because they are having an international push right now for a world government. And they want that war to cause so much chaos that they can say, well, come on, we all need to get together and sort this out. But they want to dominate the outcome. And that's how crazy they are. They're okay. Not interested in a multipolar world with different countries having different cultures, different points of view. They're trying to force the issue by forcing a world war. And Bahrain is just one more puppet on that string.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, you have US's Fifth Fleet that's stationed there. Rabbi, you have the UK that established a military base in the year 2018, which it said was to strengthen its presence in West Asia. Of course, when you have these two countries that are supposedly the flag bearers of democracy right under their nose, as you mentioned, 2,000 prisoners of conscience, torture, abuses, etc., puts into question why they are overlooking that. But is the bigger question right across that bridge by the name of Saudi Arabia, which is why the U.S. Wanted to prevent this revolution from progressing at the rate that it was, because it was right at the back door of Saudi Arabia, and it couldn't afford for the kingdom to pretty much have its population rise against it. Do you agree with that?
It could be. I don't have facts about that, but yes, it could be like that. Anyway, today the Bahrain people are given a second chance to the government, to the Al Khalifa dynasty. But it does. But there is no loom that the authorities will respond to the peaceful demands. But about the political reasons behind why the U.S. is doing that, or we really don't know. But we do know for a fact that the USA and Britain can simply order the Bahrain authorities not to repress its people, and the Bahrain authorities will be more than happy to comply, because it is the orders of its masters. They just don't, because they don't care about the Bahraini people, and because maybe, as you say, it is for their benefit that the Bahraini people are being repressed.
The way that the opposition has been crushed is really, in a sense, but farcical, Tony Gosling, when you take a look at the 2022 elections. I don't know if you recall, they held elections, but there were no opposition candidates. So they came out and they raved about the fact that there was such a turnout, you had so many people that came out, but they had banned the opposition candidates from this. I mean, that's whitewashing the whole thing. Basically, you had the two obviously main opposition groups who were banned from this. Again, it puts into question this notion of democracy that it seems like it's important for them to display to the world, so people get an idea that there is maybe some notion of that, but clearly there's not.
Well, look, it's an insult to the intelligence of Bahrainis, and it's an insult to the intelligence of every human being on planet Earth. This is a sham democracy. It's basically a puppet show, a stage show, and the idea that we all believe everything that we see on the Western television. I'm afraid this is one of my colleagues for the stupid people. The idea is that nobody actually understands what's really going on, except the people maybe in Bahrain itself. And this is, of course, it falls at the feet of the Western press. The Western press is dominated. I used to work for the BBC myself, and I can tell you, it's now become just a propaganda machine. The sort of thing when I was growing up, we were told went on in the Soviet Union. The idea that, you know, you've got a command economy and a one-party state. Effectively, you've got exactly the same in Bahrain, a one-party state, and democracy is a sham. But this will come to a head, and when the rubber hits the road, as they say, I'm quite certain that the Bahraini people will get what they want, but it may not be for a while yet, and there may well be much, much greater conflagration. Of course, the Middle East, the big focus for the West point of view, still is the oil supplies. And I wonder, and I think the case is that the reason the West is going very anti-oil is because they know there's going to be a war, and they know that that war will threaten their supply of oil. So that's why they're going bananas right now about electric cars and things like that. They're trying to stop oil because they know a war is coming. And I don't like to be the harbinger of bad news, but as far as I can see, both in Central Europe and Eastern Europe and in the Middle East, the forces of darkness are really trying to push. And that's why they're not discussing, that's not why they're not debating. But I wonder whether many of these caliphates and the people who are running the Gulf states realize what's going on. I'd like to warn them. Watch out. Do not trust the USA. Do not trust your Western backers.
Sure. Well, and don't trust Israel. I think that's another thing that, again, Rabbi, we can discuss a little bit more. In my question to you, and there was somewhat shocking act that occurred between Israel and the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, where Israel bought an island there. I think it was to the tune of $150 million, where you had the daughter of one of the activists come out with a tweet that said, that's best described as colonial expansion from a foreign ruling family that occupied Bahrain violently and has been ruling it violently. How dangerous is the Israeli factor in this, do you think?
The Bahraini authorities deal with Bahrain as if it's their property. I mentioned that earlier. This is definitely very much dangerous because they are selling lands. They not just this island. They are selling other lands in the mainland of Bahrain. It's all an island, a big island, but they are selling lands. It's as if they're turning it to a second Palestine. In some protests, people actually held banners that said we don't want to become a second Palestine because they're turning it into like a Jew. They say it's Judaism project or something like that. As I agree totally with your other guest when he spoke about the Bahraini authorities should be aware of their future because the USA has no future in being the solely pole in the world anymore. Today, the Bahraini authorities can still go back, can still go back in their steps, can still take their opportunity that is still given by the opposition, and I really don't see that they will do, but we can just hope. About the elections, I would like to say, please, I would like to comment.
Quickly.
This is the third consecutive elections that happened this way. Opposition leaders who used to represent more than 60% of voters are now in prison and are not allowed to be elected anymore. That's how sham it is, and nobody cares in the whole world.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there again, everybody. We appreciate it. Researcher, Bahrain Forum for Human Rights from Beirut, Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the wake of widespread criticisms of the United States for sanctions against Syria that had disrupted the process of providing aid to earthquake victims, the White House finally announced that it had issued a six-month waiver for some interactions related to recovery and rescue efforts after the earthquake. But it seems that Washington cancelled these restrictions only on paper and to deceive public opinion. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Arabic language television network Al Ahad has covered this story and tells us more. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad censured the West's double standards in dealing with the victims of the recent devastating earthquake that has hit both Syria and Turkey, saying Western nations are indifferent to the humanitarian situation in his country. Bashar al-Assad made the remarks in a speech during his first visit to quake-hit areas in northwestern Syria on Friday, 10th of February. He added, "The double standards of the West is nothing new and have existed since six centuries ago." The Syrian president pledged to work non-stop to help the victims of the devastating earthquake and reduce their problems as much as possible. He said, "The president does not send messages to the people, but rather receives messages from his people to reapply them, and our message is sincere and honest work." President Assad also said Syrians don't talk, they take action, adding that the people of his country have resisted problems over the past 12 years whilst adhering to their values and will overcome this natural disaster as well. Bashar al-Assad said this resistance carries a message and it is more eloquent than any words. The disastrous earthquake hit Turkey and neighbouring Syria in the early hours of Monday morning, 6th of February. The 7.8 magnitude earthquake has so far killed more than 30,000 people in total in the two countries. Calls are growing for the United States and its allies to remove their sanctions on Syria, which officials and relief workers on the ground say are hampering international aid efforts in the country. Separately, on Friday, 10th of February, Sivanka Dhanapala, the Syria representative of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, said more than 5 million Syrians may be homeless after the earthquake. Dhanapala said, "That is a huge number and comes to a population already suffering mass displacement. For Syria, this is a crisis within a crisis." Meanwhile, Bathena Shaban, President Assad's political and media advisor, lambasted the United States and the West for having no regards for Syrian people's lives, saying all their claims about humanitarian issues in Syria are false. Bathena Shaban said what worsens the already tough circumstances in Syria following the earthquake is the United States and European coercive economic measures that prevents Syria from developing methods to help people trapped under the rubble. She also said the Americans claimed that they allowed humanitarian aid to enter Syria, but this is not true, as Western countries have no humanitarian consideration and only look at the political situation contrary to what they claim. Shaban said the United States is committing a crime against the Syrian people by preventing any country from helping Syria. She said European countries have not provided any help to Syria to deal with the aftermath of the earthquake. The website of Al Mayadeen television network has also covered this story and tells us more. Syria has dismissed the United States' decision to purportedly issue a 6-month sanctions exemption for all transactions related to providing disaster relief after a powerful earthquake, describing the U.S.'s measure as misleading. The Syrian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates said in a statement on Friday, 10th of February, "This misleading decision taken by the U.S. administration to temporarily ease some of the cruel and unilateral sanctions on the Syrian nation is out of sham and hypocrisy, and is no different from previous gestures meant to convey an erroneous humanitarian impression. While the sanctions waiver is proclaimed to allow the flow of humanitarian aid to Syria, the realities on the ground prove the other way round." The statement added, "U.S. coercive measures and policies have deprived Syrians of their natural wealth, which is being plundered, and have created obstacles for state institutions to improve living standards in the country, to implement development projects and achieve targeted goals and provide basic services to the Syrian people." The statement by the Syrian Ministry of Foreign Affairs noted, "The U.S. administration cannot deceive Syrians and the world public opinion with the new decision, project an incredible image of itself, and abdicate responsibility for obstruction of rescue efforts to victims of the earthquake who are in dire need of basic commodities." The Syrian Foreign Ministry went on to call on Washington to immediately and unconditionally lift all anti-Syria sanctions, to stop its hostile practices, and put an end to its violations of international law and the United Nations Charter. It also urged all countries and international organizations to push for unconditional removal of illegal and inhumane sanctions imposed on the Syrian people. Meanwhile, the Russian Reconciliation Center for Syria says relevant international organizations are not helping Syrians affected by the devastating earthquake. The head of Russian Reconciliation Center for Syria, Major General Oleg Yegorov, said on Friday, 10th of February, "We have to draw the international community's attention to the fact that these institutions are dodging their responsibilities and do not render assistance to the Syrian victims of the earthquake." The website of Press TV has also covered this issue and tells us more. Hezbollah downplays Washington's alleged temporary and partial waiver of its sanctions against Syria, which the United States has recently issued under the pretext of facilitating relief missions in the earthquake-stricken country. The Lebanese resistance movement's Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qassem, made the remark in a tweet on Friday, 10th of February. Sheikh Naim Qassem wrote, "The American administration, with its implementation of the Caesar sanctions and blockade of Syria and its people, is devoid of all humanitarian standards. Syria has been a target of U.S. sanctions since 1979. The United States and its allies intensified their sanctions against Syria and its people in 2011, after the nation found itself in the grip of rampant and hugely deadly foreign-backed violence. Strengthening the sanctions even further, the United States approved the Caesar Act in 2019, targeting any individual and any business that participated either directly or indirectly in Syria's reconstruction efforts." Earlier on Friday, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control issued the waiver for the Caesar Act sanctions, allegedly authorizing earthquake relief transactions for a period of 6 months. Sheikh Naim Qassem went on to assert that the sanctions waiver would not serve to change America's barbarous face. Hezbollah itself issued a statement recently announcing the mobilization of all of the movement's capacities towards helping out in the disaster-hit northwestern Syria. The movement's relief endeavors have featured dispatching convoys of humanitarian aid to the earthquake-affected areas of Syria as well as the collection of foodstuffs, medicines and first aid material for transfer to Syria. Syria's Foreign Minister, Faisal Maqdad, has also highlighted Syria's need for humanitarian assistance after the earthquake, warning that U.S. sanctions have worsened the circumstances of the country as the illegal bans have prevented the delivery of everything to the country. Faisal Maqdad said, "What exacerbated the tragedy and the catastrophe was the sanctions imposed by the United States and Western countries on Syria."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio.